turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins. And now we're talking about the third of the lives of the three patriarchs, Yaakov. And it begins here, Parsha Vayetze, in Bereshit, or Genesis 28:10. And it says in English, "And Yaakov went out." And in the Hebrew, of course, the first unique word there is Vayetze. In other words, "And he," Yaakov, "went out from the place called Beersheba and went towards Haran." And we're going to hear the story of basically now Jacob's journey north. And this is a 20-plus year odyssey. He leaves basically in fear of his life, been told, "Go get yourself a wife, head on up north to the family place." And en route, he stops, and here is one of probably the most famous stories in Yaakov's life, anyway. You might even have heard the term Jacob's Ladder. Now, when I was a kid growing up, we had the science fiction things. I had a neon sign transformer that produced 20,000 volts and a little V-shaped wires you've seen, and the arc would start at the bottom and go up to the top towards heaven. Well, that's been called Jacob's Ladder. I don't think it's exactly what we're talking about here, but at least we'll see how it kind of works. So Yaakov gets to this place. He tarries there all night because the sun was heading down. He took one of the stones that he found there, put it under his head, and made that as a pillow. I guess I've had better pillows, hopefully. In any case, he dreamed, and behold, he saw a ladder set up on Haaretz and stretching towards the top, towards Hashemayim, up to the heavens. And behold, there were Malachim, angels, messengers of Elohim, descending and ascending on it. And then Yahuwah stood beside him, and he said, "Ani Yahuwah, Elohim of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land whereupon you lie, to you will I give it and to your seed." So he too is now going to get a first-person repetition of the promises that I am pretty sure he's probably heard before that were given to his father and his father before that. "Your seed," it says, "shall be as the dust of the earth. You'll spread abroad to the west, to the east, north, and the south. And in you and in your seed shall all of the families of the earth," Haaretz, "be blessed. And behold, I am with you, and I'll keep you whithersoever you go, and I'll bring you back into this land, for I will not leave you until I've done that which I have spoken to you of." So Yaakov awakens out of his sleep, and he says something that I find kind of interesting. It does not translate completely, or at least it's usually not translated in English the way it probably, say, the sages should be. He says, "Surely Yahuwah is in this place, and I knew it not." Okay, well, there's a little bit more to that. Actually, there's quite a bit more to that. And I like this rendering, because what he really says is, "Anoki lo yadati." They anoki and I lo adati. That's the word that means no in the literally as basic emotional, first person, experiential, absolute, positively, I knew it. And, you know, of course, that yada is the same word that's used when Adam knew his wife. So here is something that's really key. And it says, "And I," better translator, "and I knew it not." Now, that's a bit redundant, right? "And I knew it not." The teaching that I've heard goes with this kind of starts here and continues. And it goes like this. Basically, once he, the I part of him, awakened, that was a part that didn't know it. In other words, the claim is, and I like this implication at least, that once Yaakov got over the I part of the equation, then he realized the I really didn't know it. In other words, it's about forgetting yourself and understanding there's something much bigger, much greater, ascending up to heaven and truly seeing it. Now, the other kind of related piece that I think helps to flesh this out is this idea of why the surprise. "And I knew it not." Because, as I've said, we don't know explicitly, but I think it's almost a lead pipe cinch that in the course of his life, he has no doubt heard about one of the most important things in his father's life and in his grandfather's life before that. And that is his encounter with the Almighty. So it makes sense to me that he would have heard it. And as you know, there's a big difference between hearing something and literally yada-ing it experientially, firsthand, knowing for sure, of a certainty. And that, of course, I have no doubt, is the reason why the promise is, in fact, repeated to him directly at this point. So he thinks he knew it before. We'd probably all say, oh, yeah, well, we knew that. But now he knows it. And I didn't know it before. Really, not at all like I know it now. He was afraid, says the next verse, and said, how full of awe is this place? This is none other than the house, the Beit of Elohim, and the gate into Hashemayim. So he got up early in the morning. He took that stone that he'd put under his head. He set it up for a pillar, poured some oil on it, and called the name of that place Bet El, right? The house of El. But it was originally called Luz, it says. And there he vowed a vow. Now, this is also interesting. Here's one of the most places where you see it in the English translation, if it's done accurately. But in the Hebrew, it's perhaps a bit more clear. And notice, as I go through this, Yaakov, changes in the middle of the prayer. Okay, it says this, if Elohim will be with me, and will keep me in the way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then shall Yahuwah be my God, and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be Elohim's house, for of all, or and of all, that you... Okay, here it is. He was Elohim, and now he is you. From literally a change in the person that's given here. He's now referring to him as you rather than in the third person. And of all that you give me, I will surely give unto you a tenth. Unto thee. So that begins Jacob's journey. He heads on up the road, continues, comes to the land of the children of the east. And at this point, we get the idea, okay, he is basically back in the place where his mom came from and his grandfather before that. He looked, there's a well in the field, and look out there, whole bunch of sheep, three flocks of sheep lying by it, by the well. And out of the well, that was the place where they watered the flocks. However, there was a great big stone on the well's mouth. The Bible says it was great, and literally gadola. When I was a kid, I remember hearing a lot of stories about, you know, this Jacob must have been quite the manly man to do what we're getting ready to describe here. The Bible doesn't seem to make a huge thing about it, but it does, of course, tell us a story, so there's got to be some importance to it. The flocks were all around it, and what happened is that they, the people of the area here, rolled the stone back from the well's mouth, presumably so other folks weren't allowed to come and use it when they weren't around, and they watered their sheep. Then they put the stones, the big stone back in place when they were done. So Yaakov says to them, my brethren, where are you? Oh, well, and where are you from? And they said, well, we're from Haran. Hey, well, that sounds familiar, right? And he said to them, no, do you guys know Laban, the son of Nahor? Oh, yeah, we know him. Well, is everything hanging well with him? Is it going great with the guy? Oh, yeah, it's fine. Oh, look here. Rachel, his daughter, she is coming with the sheep. And he, and this presumably is Yaakov, says, well, you know, it's yet high day, not time that the cattle should be gathered together. Water the sheep, though. Go and feed them. Well, they say we can't, not until all the flocks are gathered together, and they rolled the stone back from the well's mouth. Then we water the sheep. So while he was yet speaking with him, here comes Rachel with her father's sheep. She's the one that took care of him. And it came to pass when Yaakov saw Rachel, Rachel, daughter of Laban, his mother's brother. So let's see. Mother's brother, that would be his uncle Laban. His daughter would be his cousin. And he saw the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother. Yaakov went near, and I guess he was looking to impress the young lady. He rolls the stone back from the mouth of the well, single-handedly, it sounds like, watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. And it says here, Yaakov kissed Rachel. He lifted up his voice and wept. Now, always, when we read this verse, the question is, why? And there are all kinds of explanations. Is it grief or is it joy? And perhaps the answer is some of both. And maybe he has an understanding of at least some of the things to come. Okay, so Yaakov tells Rachel that he, in fact, was her father's brother. at least kin-wise, and that he was Rivka's son, and she ran and told her dad. And it came to pass, when Laban heard the tidings of Yaakov, his sister's son, he ran to meet him, embraced him, kissed him, brought him into the house, and he told Laban all these things. Now remember, at this point, I have a suspicion Laban is probably thinking back to the last time he saw somebody from the house of Abraham and figured, oh, this is like the gravy train coming to town again. So Laban tells him, surely you are my flesh and my bone. And he abode with him, stayed with him for the space of a month. Finally, he says to Jacob, look, because you're my brother, how should you serve me? You shouldn't serve me for nothing, right? So tell me, what kind of wages should you have? And then we're told Laban had two daughters, name of the elder one, Leah, the name of the younger one, Rachel. And we get this explanation, Leah's eyes were weak. Rachel, though, was of beautiful form and fair to look upon. And Yaakov, it says, loved Rachel. And he said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. Well, says Laban, better I give her to you than some other guy. So, yeah, hang on in there, abide with me, and we'll work that deal out. So Yaakov served 7 years for Rachel. That didn't seem to him to be very long at all, just a few days, because of the love that he had for her. And eventually he says to Laban, presumably 7 years later, give me my wife, for my days are now fulfilled, so that I may go into her. And we know what that means. Literally, the word there that we get translated in English is take her, to yada her. So Laban gathered all the men of the place together. He made a big feast. Must have been a really big feast. We'll probably talk about this just a little bit. I'm sure by now everybody's heard all of the speculations. How could this possibly happen? Because we do know what's going to happen. So there's a big feast, and Laban takes the older daughter, not the one that was promised, Leah, and brings her to him. He doesn't figure it out, at least not in time. He does the deed, takes her, literally. And, well, we'll get to that in a second. Also, it says, Laban gave Zilpah, his handmaid, unto his daughter Leah, so that she would have a handmaid. So there's a gift that's given to the new bride here, and that is Zilpah. Now, there is a lot of speculation. I can't prove this, but it does kind of tend to make a lot of sense. And that is that Zilpah was probably a half-sister to Leah, of a bondservant. In other words, that one of Laban's wives that was a concubine probably bore Bilhah and Zilpah. And they are, in fact, half-sisters to the other girls. Makes sense that when they marry and go off, that he would allow one of the sisters to go with them. So it came to pass in the morning, as it says here, behold, ho, I thought you were you're Leah. And then he goes to his father-in-law, and he says, what the heck have you done to me? Didn't I serve you for Rachel 7 years? Why, he says, have you beguiled me? At this point, I guess I'll pause just a minute. Again, no shortage of speculation on this point. I don't have a favorite understanding. Honestly, I don't think I believe that that Yaakov was drunk. I do believe that probably Yaakov was blinded. He may have been blinded by a little bit of alcoholic mist. He may have been blinded by his desire for Rachel. He may have been blinded by the fact that, hey, who would possibly be doing anything untoward here? And it may have just been that when he got into the midst of the dirty deed, he thought, well, not the dirty deed, the clean deed, I'm sorry. He thought, okay, well, I'm not sure. But, okay, what the heck, right? We don't know, other than what we're told in the next line. Now, there is, again, no shortage of midrashic speculation as well, including the fact that, okay, maybe Rachel and Leah had made some kind of a deal. Maybe Yaakov and Rachel had suspected something like this might go on. I've heard the story, oh, there was a secret key so that he would be able to hear from Rachel if they tried to pull the switcheroo. You know, I don't have too much faith in those simply because, come on, if it wasn't the switcheroo, how much planning did it take in advance to figure out which one was which? But in any case, Laban gives him the straight skinny at this point. He says, look, it's not done that way in our place to give the younger before the firstborn. Now, here's one more place. Part of the reason why I mentioned some of the Midrash, the teachings on this, is that there is a veiled kind of a gotcha here that's being communicated through Laban to Yaakov. In other words, hey, you know, when it comes to the right of the firstborn, hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you secondborn that took the birthright and the blessing, well, we don't do that here. So I can't deny that there's at least some possibility of that. In 7 years, the story may have gotten told. So again, all of these things are just but speculation. As a result, then, we try not to build a doctrine on them. But I think it is kind of interesting, useful even, to Midrash, to kick it around, discuss it, and to try to put ourselves in the position of these people and see what was it they could have been thinking. How could this possibly have happened? And as good of an explanation as anything is just that this is the way it was supposed to happen. Anyway, he says, fill the week of this one. In other words, honor the marital vows and give Leah her full week of being the new wife. And then I'll give you the other one too. And, oh, by the way, I'm going to sign up for another 7 years. Ha, ha, ha. So Yaakov did so. He fulfilled the week for Rachel, for Leah. And then he did, in fact, at the end of a week, get Rachel, his other daughter, to be a wife. And this time, Rachel also gets a handmaid. In her case, it's Bilhah to be her handmaid. And then it says, here comes what sounds like a mistake. Yaakov went in also unto Rachel. Okay, so far so good. And he loved Rachel more than Leah. Well, in a way, that shouldn't surprise us, right? We've already been told he's loved Rachel. He wanted Rachel for 7 years. He kind of feels like he's been slighted during the first wedding. It doesn't really surprise me too much that he might have had feelings for Rachel that were greater than those he has for Leah. Obviously, he's come to know Leah at this point, both in a figurative sense and in a more intimate sense as well. The other thing that you can't help but wonder is, okay, now what are the family dynamics here? Everybody involved seems to have lied to poor Yaakov. Where's Rachel? Why didn't she step forward, right? Was she locked away, unable to say anything? Why didn't somebody flip on the light? Well, at least light a candle. How could he have been so deceived? What about Leah herself, right? Was she was clearly part of this. She didn't say anything to him. At least that's presumably what happened. Maybe she did. Who knows? But one way or the other, we are where we are. And when it's all said and done, the mistake, and we're going to see this repeated a couple times in the Scriptures, the mistake that Yaakov made is he showed clear, undeniable favoritism to Rachel. He has two wives, and he is not even remotely trying to be equitable in terms of the way he's treating Leah. And in fact, the next verse says, Yahuwah saw that Leah was hated, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Now, here's another one of those places where the word hated, I'm not sure, is a great translation. Or at least a great understanding is probably a better way to put it. No doubt about it, there was clear favoritism here. Is hated the same? Well, wait a minute. If he hated Leah, why is he occasionally obviously lying with her and she's bringing forth sons? So he couldn't have hated her that much. She was just clearly less favored. Anyway, Leah then conceives. As she bears a son, first one was called Reuben. And literally, Reu-ben. Okay, Ben, we know, that's the name, that the word that means son. And the probably the best rendering of Reu-ben is, hey, look, see, behold, a son. And the explanation that she gives, now remember, this is Leah that seems to be naming the boys here. Because Yahuwah has looked upon my affliction, and now, she says, surely my husband will love me. Wow, now there certainly is some sadness reflected in that. Look, behold a son, maybe my husband will love me now. One other comment I'm going to make as we go through the next few verses and the names here is that if you understand this and look at the common thread, these names all seem to have to do with poor Leah essentially saying, you know what? Maybe if I keep doing this and doing it right and bringing sons into this marriage, maybe my husband will really appreciate me. Maybe he will truly love me. All of the names have to do, in other words, one way or another, with a relationship that she is looking for with her husband and doesn't seem to find. She conceived again, says the next verse, then bore another son, because Yahuwah has heard that I'm hated. Therefore, he's given me this son also. Shema. Shimeon. That's the root word there. And remember, Shema is also to hearken, to guard, or to hear and obey. So the creator of the universe has heard, and he has hearkened to her pleas. She conceived again, she bore another son. Now it says, this time, finally, my husband will be joined unto me, because I have borne him three sons. So the root word there, to join, Leva. So she called his name Levi. And then she conceived again, bore yet another son, and says, this time I will praise Yahuwah. So she called his name Yehuda. And that was it for her bearing, at least for a little while. Meanwhile, what about Rachel? Well, she is seeing that she is not bearing any children. Her sister, though, is. And for that reason, she envied her sister. Now, this is the one that is the more favored. And yet she envies the sister who is less favored, at least by the husband, but clearly favored in a whole different way by the Creator. She tells Yaakov, give me some children or else I'll just keel over and die. And that made Yaakov pretty angry. He says, look, am I in the stead of Elohim? Am I the one who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? Clearly not. And we know a couple of things. We know that Yaakov is obviously fertile at this point, and that we can kind of presume that had there been anything other than barrenness, at least up until this point, in Rachel, she would have borne. But she didn't. So she comes up with a solution. It's not a solution we haven't seen before. Behold, check it out, I have a handmaid, Bilhah, go into her, so that she may bear upon my knees, and I might be built up through her. So she is literally going to be what we would now probably call a surrogate wife, to bear children on behalf of Rachel, or at least to bear children, bring children into the family, and Rachel is going to hopefully get some credit for it, because it was her idea, if nothing else. So she gave Bilhah, her handmaid, to Yaakov for a wife, and he, in fact, did go into her. And sure enough, Bilhah conceives, bears Yaakov a son. And Rachel now is going to name this son. She says, Elohim has judged me. What's the root word for judge there? Dan. He's also heard my voice, and he's given me a son. So his name was called Dan. Bilhah, Rachel's handmaid, conceived again. She bore Yaakov a second son. With mighty wrestlings, she says, I have wrestled with my sister, and I have prevailed. And that one's name she called Naphtali. And then when Leah is watching all of this going on, okay, two sons, we're talking a period of probably several years at this point, and she realizes she seems to have quit doing the bearing thing herself for a while. So she takes Zilpah, her handmaid, and gave her to Yaakov as a wife too. So now Zilpah's handmaid bears Yaakov a son, and the name here is Gad, for fortune, or troop, literally. So that is his name. Zilpah, Leah's handmaid, bore Yaakov a second son. Happy am I, Asher, right? How happy am I? For the daughters will call me happy, so the name there, Asher. And now we're going to have a pause. Now, this is part of the story I always find kind of interesting, and people do tend to scratch their heads. There's actually a couple places in the story of Yaakov where we want to scratch our heads. One has to do with sheep that are spotted and speckled and are looking at various sticks. That seems to make a difference somehow. It's not obvious. And there's this one. How about the mandrakes, right? Reuben is out there in the days of the wheat harvest. He found some mandrakes. He brings them to his mother, Leah. And Rachel says to Leah, give me those mandrakes, I pray. Well, is that a small matter? She says that you've taken away my husband. Would you take away my son's mandrakes as well? The implication here seems to be that mandrakes are presumably thought to be some kind of an aphrodisiac or an aid of some kind. So Rachel says, well, therefore, he shall lie with you tonight for those mandrakes. So here comes Yaakov in from the field, Leah goes out to meet him, says, I have purchased you tonight. You, this is going to be some night. I have hired you with my son's mandrakes. Well, says Yaakov, okay, I guess I've heard worse. What the heck? And he lay with her, and Elohim hearkens to Leah, and she conceived and bears Yaakov yet a fifth son. She has given me, Elohim has given me my hire, he says, because I also gave my handmaid to my husband, and that name is Issachar, literally meaning to hire or bear or take away or carry. Leah conceives again. She bears another son to Yaakov. He has endowed me now, she says, with a good dowry. So now my husband will dwell with me because I have given him six sons. Number six is Zebulun, the root word there from dwell. And finally, she bears a daughter too, called her name Dinah. It's been a long time. Everybody has had children in the entire family, all three of the other wives, except for Rachel. And then it says, the root word here, right, Zakar, to remember, or called to mind, I guess. It's time. Elohim Zakard Rachel. And he hearkened to her, and he opened her womb. And finally, Rachel conceives. She bears a son, and she says, Elohim has taken away my reproach. Literally, has gathered up my reproach. And now, in this one, there are all kinds of references. Take away my reproach. Of course, the thing that I immediately think of is a famous prophecy from Isaiah 4:1, where we see the prophet says, talking about a time that I suspect we're getting closer to by the day, of course we have to be because it hadn't happened yet, is in that day seven women will take a hold of one man, not just four, but seven, saying, Take away my reproach. But ultimately, what they're going to do is reference Exodus, where there are three duties of marriage. Food, raiment, food, clothing, in other words, and the duty of providing covering and love to the wife. And here you have women saying, look, I'm happy with just one out of the three. I'll have my own food, my own clothing. I'll provide my own food, my own raiment, and just simply let me be called by your name to take away my reproach. So here is a similar reference. Now Rachel has had her reproach taken away, and she calls his name Yosef. First use. Again, having this root of to take away the scorn or the taunting or the shame. And adding to the implication of increase, which is also implied by the word. And Yahuwah add to me another son. So at this point, came to pass that when Rachel had finally born Yosef, Yaakov says to his father-in-law, Laban, send me away. I need to head back on down south to my own country. Give me my wives and my children, the ones for whom I've served you. Now, we're up to 14 years at this point. Let me go, because you know the service that I've served you. Well, Laban, of course, is not anxious to see this gravy train end. He says to his son-in-law, look, if I have now found favor in your eyes, look, I've been watching, I've observed the signs. Clearly, Yahuwah has blessed me for your sake. Laban's not blind. He can see that this has been a good deal for him. So he says, name your wages. I'll give it to you. Well, the response comes, you know how well I've served you, how well your cattle have fared with me. Meaning all of his livestock. You know how good of a steward I've been. You didn't have very much before I came, and it has clearly increased abundantly. And you have been blessed abundantly by Yahuwah wherever I turned. So, now, isn't it time for me to begin to provide for my own house as well? So, Yaakov is setting up what he is fixing to ask for here with a very reasonable request. And there's another implication. I do find this one kind of interesting in the commentaries, and it goes something like this. We're going to see lots of indications as to the character of Laban or Lavan. And for the most part, he does seem to be a kind of a fellow, we've already seen it once in this Torah portion, who is more than open to a little bit of chicanery when it suits his purposes. I wouldn't call him a crook or outright dishonest, but he's... The best example, if you ever remember a show called Green Acres, I tell this story periodically, there was a fellow named Mr. Haney who was always showing up at the farm in that old 60s comedy show. And he was kind of an operator, okay? You need something? I got it. Now, it wasn't always going to be the best quality. He wasn't an outright crook, but he definitely was willing to cut corners, and the merchandise might not be first rate that he had. But whatever it is, we got a deal to be made. I think he's honest. The comment comes more like Eddie Haskell. Now, Eddie Haskell was probably a little bit less so even than Mr. Haney, if you remember Leave It to Beaver. But in any case, we get the idea here. Laban is not a guy who is at the utmost in integrity. Nevertheless, he's probably far better in integrity than anybody in the Florida election process, for example. Okay, so Laban listens. Well, what shall I give you? He says. All right, here comes the response. Well, don't give me anything. If you'll do this thing for me, I will again feed your flock and I'll take care of it. And I'll pass through all the flock daily and I'll remove from there, at least this is the original deal, I'll get all the speckled and spotted ones and the dark ones among the sheep, the spot and the speckles, and those will be my hire. So basically, all the uniform color you get to keep, anything that's speckled and spotted, those are mine. So shall my righteousness witness against me hereafter. So what he's saying is, you can check this out. Here's the deal. You can check the flocks. You can see whether I'm doing what I said I would do or not. My righteousness will witness. When you come to look over my hire that's before you, everyone that's not speckled and spotted among the goats, dark, if you found that in my care, you can call that stolen. First use there. Ganuv. Stolen. We're going to later see it in the Ten Commandments, of course. But this is the first time it appears in Scripture. Well, says Laban, behold, that sounds pretty good. Let it be according to your word. So from that day forward, Yaakov goes, he removes the he-goats that were streaked and spotted, and all the she-goats that were speckled and spotted, every one that had white in it, all the dark ones among the sheep, he gave them into the hand of his sons. And he set 3 days' journey between himself and Yaakov. And Yaakov fed the rest of Laban's flocks too. Now here we get the other part that I say is a little bit, people scratch their heads. What is really going on here? Yaakov clearly, if this is all we know, has been given some kind of insight by the Creator that I'll admit I don't think modern animal husbandry seems to have a good clue about. He took rods, in other words, wooden sticks of fresh poplar and of the almond tree and the plane tree, and he peeled white streaks in them, making the white appear which was in the rods. So he's literally carving the surface, taking the bark off of these sticks or rods so that the white that's in the middle shows through. And he set the rods which he peeled over against the flocks in the gutters of the watering troughs. So when the sheep come, or the goats come to water, they're drinking, they look at these sticks, and somehow or other, that does the deed. So they conceive when they come to drink. All the flocks conceived at the sight of the rods, and they brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted in abundance. So Yaakov separated the lambs. He also set the faces of the flocks towards the streaked and all the dark in the flock of Laban. He put his own droves apart, and he didn't mix them with Laban's flock. And it came to pass that whenever the stronger of the flock conceived, Yaakov laid the rods before the eyes of the flock there in the gutters that they might conceive among the rods. In other words, he put the sticks out when he saw the best ones coming to drink. And when they were a little bit more feeble, not quite as good, he didn't put them in. So the offspring that were feebler ended up going to Laban's flocks, while the stronger ones were Yaakov's. And he increased exceedingly. And he had large flocks and maidservants and men servants and camels and asses. Which, of course, as you might suspect, over a period of years, causes some more issues. So then he heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, Yaakov has taken away everything of our fathers. He's gotten all this wealth. And he sees what Laban is looking, and behold, somehow or other something's changed. So Yahuwah says to Yaakov, time, return unto the land of your fathers, to your kin, and I will be with you. So Yaakov sent, he called Rachel and Leah to the field, to his flock, and he says, I can see your dad is not looking at me quite the same way he was. But the Elohim of my father has in fact been with me. Now you know that with all my power I have served your father. And he's mocked me. And now we're going to be told something else. Look, he has changed my wages. He's changed the deal here no less than 10 times. But Elohim kept him from actually hurting me. And he reminds them what that means. And this is the first time we're reading about it. He says, look, if he said the speckled will be your wages, then the flock bore speckled. But if he said instead the streaked will be your wages, well, then the flock all bore streaked. So Elohim has taken away the cattle of your father and given them to me. And it came to pass at the time that the flock conceived, I lift up my eyes, and I see in a dream, and behold, the he-goats which leaped upon the flock were streaked, speckled, and grizzled. And the Malak, the angel, the messenger of Elohim, then said to me in that dream, Yaakov, right, Yaakov, response, Hineni, here I am. And he said, lift up your eyes, see, all the he-goats which leap upon the flock are streaked, speckled, and grizzled. For I have seen what Laban is doing to you. Ani, the El of Bet-El. I am the Elohim of that place. Remember, Beth-El, the house of El, where you anointed a pillar, and you made that vow to me. So arise, he says, get out of this land, and return to the land of your nativity. So Rachel and Leah, they answered him, and they said to their husband, is there yet any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we literally to be held by him as if we were strangers? He sold us, and he's devoured our price. For all the riches which Elohim has taken away from our father, that's ours and our children's. So, yeah, okay, understand this. Whatever it is that Elohim has told you to do, do it. So Yaakov rose up, he got his sons and his wives, he put them on camels, and he carried away everything that he had been given, all of his substance, cattle of his gathering in the Padan Aram, and he was getting ready to head back down to Isaac, his father, in the land of Canaan. Meanwhile, Laban is out to shear the sheep, and while that was happening, a bad thing happens too, and we're not ever told precisely, as far as I know, why she did this. But Rachel went and stole some of the idols, the teraphim, that belonged to her father. And Yaakov, it says, outwitted Laban, the Aramean, in that he didn't tell him he was fixing to head out. So he rose up, fled with all he had, passed over the river, set his face towards the mountain of Gilead, and he headed out and headed south. Laban didn't hear about it until the third day after Yaakov was gone. So he took his brethren with him. Now, brethren here, of course, obviously is a reference to all kinds of family. That's the general understanding of the Hebrew scholars. Okay, he's talking about a pretty good troop of folks, not just his own brothers, but sons and other kin. He pursued after him 7 days' journey. Took him a while to catch up. He overtook him in the mountain of Gilead. And when this happens, now Laban's going to get his own dream. Elohim comes to him, Laban the Aramean. My father was a wandering Aramean. You notice we've heard that twice now in a few verses. He says to him, take heed to yourself that you speak to Yaakov neither good nor bad. Guard your tongue. Speak to him neither good nor bad. He is keeping Laban on the straight and narrow. So Laban comes up, catches up with Yaakov, who'd pitched his tent there in the mountain, and Laban and his brethren had pitched in the mountain of Gilead. And Laban says to his son-in-law, what have you done? You've outwitted me. You carried away my daughters as if they were captives by the sword. Why did you flee in secret? You outwitted me. Why didn't you tell me that I might have sent you away with a big going-away party, right? With songs, tabret, harp. And you didn't even let me kiss my daughters and my sons goodbye. That's a foolish thing you've done. It is in the power of my hand to do you hurt. I could have my way with you. I could do nasty stuff. But the Elohim of your fathers, he did talk to me in the night, and he said, take heed to yourself that you speak not to Yaakov either good nor bad. So he's at least telling him the truth at this point. And surely, now that you're gone, because you, I can understand this, you long to go to your father's house, why have you stolen my teraphim, my gods, my Elohim? Huh? What? Well, Yaakov answers, because I was afraid. He's answering question A, why did you leave in secret? I was afraid. Because I thought you might try to take your daughters from me by force. Now, as to that second part about whoever's taking your teraphim, your so-called gods, that one will not live. Let me pause here. Now, I've got this marked in my margin, and every time I read this, I can't help but have a twinge. We are told, remember, to guard the words of our mouth. Don't make a vow. Don't let idle words escape. Be very careful of what you prophesy or what you bind your soul to do. That's Numbers 30. But it seems like in this case, even though it hasn't been written down yet, presumably Yaakov should have known better. You find those gods, that person will not live. You can take it with you too. And then it tells us, it's clear here, Yaakov did not realize that it was in fact his beloved wife Rachel who had taken them, who had stolen them. There's that word again. Well, Laban went into Yaakov's tent. He went into Leah's tent. He went into the tents of the two maidservants. He didn't find them. He went out of Leah's tent. He entered into Rachel's tent. Now, where is she hiding them? Rachel had taken them. She put them on the saddle of the camel. And she was literally sitting upon them at the point where this search is going on. So Laban checked out everywhere he could find. He couldn't find them. And Rachel then says to her father, let not my lord be angry. I can't rise up before you because I'm in the matter of women. It's my time of the month, in other words. So she managed to keep him from finding them where they were hidden. He didn't get them. Jacob was wroth, and he strove with Laban. And he answered and said, What the heck is going on here? What's my sin, my trespass, that you have pursued after me so hotly? Whereas you felt around about all my stuff, you did your full search, man. You didn't find it, right? If you did, set it here before my brethren and your brethren. Let's judge between the two of us. I've been with you 20 years serving you. Your ewes, your she-goats haven't cast their young. The rams of your flock I hadn't eaten. Anything that was torn by beasts, I absorbed that loss. You required it anyway, though, even though if you understand the instruction, that's not quite right. If it was stolen by day or by night, in any case, it was me that made it good. And here's how it was for me. In the day, I was consumed by drought and the frost by night, and my sleep fled from before my eyes. In other words, I worked my you-know-what off for you. This is the thanks I get. 20 years I've been in your house. I served 14 years for your two daughters, 6 years for the flock, and you have, in the interim, changed my wages 10 times. Except for the Elohim of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been on my side, surely by now you'd have sent me away empty-handed. Elohim has seen my affliction, the labor of my hands, and he gave judgment, literally, in the last day. Now, listen to Laban's response. Now, this is obviously kind of a heated conversation. Mine, mine, mine is kind of how I'm going to summarize verse 43. Laban answered, he said to Yaakov, your daughters? No, they're my daughters. Children? They're my children. The flocks? My flocks. Mine, 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 mine. And all that you see is mine. What can I do this day for these my daughters or for their children whom they've borne? All right. Oh, okay, okay, okay. Hey, let's back off here a little bit. Let's make a covenant, a brit. Go cut a brit between you and me, and let it be for a witness between me and you. So Yaakov took a stone. He set it up for a pillar, and he said to his brethren, those people, the family that were all around, gather stones. They did. They made a big heap, and they ate there by the heap. And Laban called the place Yegar Sahaduta. But Yaakov called it Galeed, literally Gal or heap, Eid or Ed for witness. So the heap of witness. Laban, though, says, this heap is therefore the witness between me and you. So again, Scripture says, yep, Galeed, heap of witness. And watchtower, mitzpah. For he says, Yahuwah watch between me and you when we are absent from one another. Here's the deal. If you afflict my daughters, you take any other wives besides these, my daughters, the four of them, no man between us. See, Elohim is my witness between me and you. And he says to Yaakov, behold, here's this heap, Galeed, and the pillar. I set it up between us. This will be witness that I will not pass over this heap your direction. You don't head back this direction over to me to do harm. So the heap is kind of like the separation point, this pillar that marks a place where neither one of us will trespass to do harm against the other. And he says, the Elohim of Abraham, the God of Nahor, God of their father, judge between us. So he names the two brothers, and Yaakov swore by the fear of his father Yitzhak. And he offered a sacrifice there in the mountain, called his brethren to eat bread. They did, and they basically hung around, had a party all night in the mountain. Early in the morning, Laban gets up, he kisses his sons, his grandsons actually, and his daughters, and he blessed them, and he departs. He returned unto his place. Now, here's another one of those interesting sentences. You can almost wash over it, kind of just read it and say, okay, he went home, big deal. Yet, there's no idle word in Torah, and there does seem to be a really interesting implication of this. This is not the Peshat level, in other words, this is the deeper level of meaning. He returned to his place. He had been blessed while Yaakov was with him for these 20 years. And presumably, as a result of his association with a guy who was morally superior to him, he had arisen a little bit. So just maybe when it says he returned to his place, it means kind of he goes back to being the old Laban. More like the Eddie Haskell than the Mr. Haney even. Yaakov went on his way, and the angels, the Malachim of Elohim, met him. And then when he got back to the place before, he said, this is God's camp. Call that name of the place this time, the camp, two camps, Mahanaim. And literally, that is where this portion ends. So we've seen an entire discussion of, let's call it the first 90% or so of Yaakov's journey. It begins with literally a meeting with the messengers of Elohim and a repetition of the promise that he has heard about, but now I didn't know it before, but I do now. Now he truly knows it. He goes to his kith and kin, and he encounters and indeed receives his four wives and his dozen sons at this point and his daughter, and he becomes a wealthy man with a whole lot of sheep and animals and goats and camels and other manservants and maidservants, and he returns headed back south. And literally at the point where we leave him, he is camping, and what we're going to see next time, of course, is, wait, one more major hurdle to come. What about that brother that was looking to kill you a while back?